Hello and welcome to New Books in Religion. I'm your co-host, Hilary Kale. Anthropologist Birgit Meyer's most recent book, Sensational Movies, explores the dynamic process of popular video filmmaking in Ghana as a new medium for the imagination that interweaves technological, economic, social, cultural, and religious aspects. Stepping into the void left by the defunct state film industry, video movies negotiate the imaginaries deployed by state cinema on the one hand and Pentecostal Christianity on the other. More specifically, Meyer shows the affinity between cinematic and Christian modes of looking and showcases the transgressive potential haunting figurations of the occult. In this in-depth account, more than two decades in the making, Meyer takes us into the nexus of imagination, imaginaries, and images in contemporary Ghana. I'm so pleased to welcome Birgit Meyer to NBIR today.
Thank you, Hilary, for this very nice introduction and also for this interview.
And in fact, Birgit is actually here with me in person, which I was saying to her is very exciting because normally our interviews on NBIR are done over Skype. But in this case, we have her here in Montreal in the studio. So this promises to be a very exciting interview. So as I noted in the introduction, the book began more than two decades ago. How did you come to the project in the beginning?
Well, I was in the early 1990s. I was still conducting research for my PhD thesis that focused on the rise of local interpretations of Christianity in Ghana. And I did that research in a village called Peki. But every now and then I came to Accra, the capital, to change money, to get mail, and so on. And all of a sudden I saw a huge billboard depicting a woman with some white foam coming out of her mouth and holding in her hand a snake with a human head. And it was advertised as a movie, Diabolo. Come and watch the latest sensation by William Akufo, obviously the filmmaker. This attracted me, in fact, to go and watch the film. And when I watched the film in a kind of public viewing, open-air setting, I was very surprised to see that the film addressed the theme of diabolic action. You get it already from the name Diabolo, that I was familiar with, but in another register, since I was doing research on Christianity and sermons and so on. And in these sermons, the devil was mobilized a lot. And so then I realized that somehow Next to Pentecostalism growing, there was also a film industry that followed quite closely in a way in that same atmosphere. And that very much kicked me off. I had to finish the dissertation first. It also came out as a book, Translating the Devil. But then when I had a new research grant, I think that was in 1996, I came back to Ghana and then really went for a close investigation of this emergent video film industry and its relationship with Christianity.
And I want to get back to that moment in the mid-90s and the emerging industry. But maybe before we go any further, it might be helpful to clarify for those listeners less familiar with your work how this study dovetails with the heuristic model that you've been developing over a number of years, the sensational form. What does that refer to, and how does that help us understand the video films in this book?
Oh yeah, that is an interesting question, and it's also nice that you pose it, because while I worked on this video project for a long time, studying also the rise of Pentecostalism at the very same time, I also sought to develop a number of theoretical notions, the sensational form being the most important one, as it were, to understand in a way the genesis of some sense of wow or surprise with regard to the supernatural. I employ the notion of sensational form in the following way. For me, sensation refers to indeed the level of sense, making sense, as well as sensation in the sense of a perception of the world, but also developing certain feelings about it. Now, I found that different religious traditions have various sensational forms that they authorize as the way to, in a way, get access to the divine or the supernatural for the people who are part of this religious tradition. Pentecostalism knows a number of sensational forms that tune people's senses, make them develop particular feelings and also modes of making sense, such as the speaking in tongues session in services and so on. So sensational forms are very much about the orchestration of modes of making sense, sensing the world, and also having certain feelings and becoming sensible to the world in particular ways. This notion came out of my research on Pentecostal Christianity, and I realized that it was productive and illuminating to use the notion of sensational form also in relation to these kinds of emergent movies, in that they also played a role in a way retuning, addressing, shaping people's habitus in a particular manner.
Yeah, and I think that that idea of an authorizing force in these sensational forms is so important in this book, and it'll come up again, of course, in our discussion.
Yeah.
And it's kind of nice, too, because as you said, that initial poster that grabbed your attention, it used the term, right? Sensation or...
That is in a way very interesting, because I took a picture of the poster, but it was on a deer and I forgot it. I think we often forget a bit about our analog media, certainly Diaz, which was something to do in the early 1990s. When I was looking for a frontispiece for the book, I wanted to get this picture. I knew I had taken it, but I had totally forgotten that it referred explicitly to the notion of sensation. And I had already agreed the book would be called Sensational Movies. I had developed the notion of sensational form. And then I realized, again, how grounded in a way also this conceptual notion was in my fieldwork experiences.
Yeah, that's right. It brings you right back to that initial moment, the newest sensation.
Exactly. And of course, I start the book with that. And I also relate it very much to, of course, sensation, not as primary and given, or let's say part of our biological setup, but sensation being streamlined via particular media that also orient people in a particular way, and that underpin, in fact, modes of sharing things, that underpin the development of a common sense in the figurative and in the literal sense, we could say.
We've been speaking then a bit about the empirical frame, we could say, for your ethnographic work. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could speak to that a bit further. Sensational Movies takes us into a number of different sites around Accra where movies are being watched and also where they're being made. Mm-hmm. Could you describe some of those places and clarify what kinds of research you did for the project and how you came to also focus your attention in the particular sites where you did?
Yes, that is a nice question, I think, and it is a huge question in a way. Perhaps, first of all, I should say that during my research in the early 1990s in Ghana, I witnessed a transformation of the Ghanaian public sphere from being very much controlled by the state owning and having control over radio, television, and the press. So it was in the mid-1990s that Ghana returned to a democratic constitution, and this entailed the liberalization and deregulation of media at the same point as, in a way, the country opened up for neoliberal capitalism. It implied that, indeed, there was a potential for an emergent public culture that was accessible to the people, made by the people, but very much under the sign of neoliberal capitalism and commercialization. Ordinary people who hitherto had not had access to media like film, radio, television, were able to access this sphere. And they did so by using and deploying, in fact, the medium of video that was brought to Ghana via Ghanaian migrants who lived in Europe and in the U.S. and who brought this technology to Ghana. Now, in the already late 1980s, there was a kind of problem in the Ghanaian setting. The film industry was even still state-run and state-dominated to produce feature films. This was very expensive, and there were no longer means for this. And in a way, a video technology was used to stand in as a substitute for celluloid. And the beginning of the video film industry was predicated on making substitutes for films. And the first video movies were also screened in the cinemas, in which no celluloid films could be shown any longer because they were not available. It was at the point when I really started my study in the mid-1990s that these movies were just being copied and made available for home use. But even in those days, movies were still shown in the cinemas and were also shown in small video parlors in the suburbs. And only after some time then were sold in video shops and so on for public viewing again. This implied that I would, of course, try to watch the latest movies as they were screened in cinemas, as they then would move into smaller, also in a way lower class neighborhoods, into very popular open air venues, until indeed people would also purchase the videos and watch them at home. It implied that my research had many different locations. I was in a way following the consumption, the screening and consumption of the movies. But gradually, as I got acquainted with the video filmmakers, with the actors and all these people, of course, I also was on set. And in the end, I managed in a way to witness the different phases, of course, the production, the distribution, as well as consumption of this kind of movies, which led me crisscross through Accra day in, day out. So my research location, in distinction to my earlier research, was not a bounded village where things would happen, but there were different nodes, in fact, where that were relevant for filmmaking and film screening. And I constantly circulated between them, often together with the video filmmakers and distributors.
So I think this was implied in what you were saying, but just to clarify, these were video films that were being produced by Ghanaians, mm-hmm. With Ghanaian actors for the Ghanaian public.
Yeah.
And I presume that the budgets were rather low most of the time for these kinds of films.
Yes, yes.
Were they being distributed more widely, or were they mainly really for that Ghanaian audience?
They circulated mainly in Ghana and also in the Ghanaian diaspora, or more broadly, English-speaking diaspora. So in my hometown, Amsterdam, I also could watch a lot of movies and follow the circulation of movies, often via piracy, of course, to the West. The filmmakers, of course, had the desire to also come out big and really attract very large audiences to these movies, but this did not prove to be as successful as the video filmmakers might have hoped for. The films are very much tied to local sensibilities and interests, and in fact, they are very much up against expectations which perhaps a European or Western audience might have with regard to an African film. Actually, these local video movies were quite distinct from the known genres, the known films, African films, forms of African art cinema that circulate in the West. Mm-hmm. One of the important features that, of course, interested me as an anthropologist, being the strong emphasis on the occult, on the devil, witchcraft, also the victoriousness of Christianity over traditional religion, and so on. So these were themes that occupied people in the local scene, but were very difficult, I think, to situate for audiences outside. Throughout my research, working with the filmmakers, I have also tried to organize screenings in Amsterdam, in certain places in the Netherlands, but I found that I always had to do my best to explain to the audiences how these movies were situated and how would they differ from African art films in order to create some interest and sympathy. So I would say, you know, the filmmakers wanted to play it very, very big globally, but that did not work like that. On the other hand, Nigerian and as well as Ghanaian movies, the two emerged around the same time, although I think the Ghanaian film industry started slightly earlier. They managed really to create huge, huge audiences on the African a continent, right? So there are so many channels now screening locally produced movies. It's unbelievable.
And some of our listeners might be more familiar with Nollywood, with the Nigerian version of this film industry, perhaps, than the Ghanaian one. But nevertheless, I mean, as you're saying, there's a link there.
There's a link, absolutely. Yeah. And Nollywood, they were only called Nollywood after a certain point. They were in the beginning years, they were called Nigerian movies, and audiences in Ghana were always also very attracted to Nigerian movies, also because Nigerian movies were less subject to local censorship than Ghanaian movies, so they were in a way more exuberant and more excessive and so on. Brian Larkin has written very, very interesting things, and Jonathan Haynes, about the Nigerian movies. So what I also found during my research was quite a rivalry, in fact, between the Ghanaian and Nigerian movies, and the Ghanaian filmmakers had to do their best to keep the audiences tuned, as it were.
Well, this is a nice segue, because you mentioned censorship in the Ghanaian context, and this brings us back to what you were saying a bit earlier about the role of the state and actually a liberalization that was happening in the mid-1990s that you were witnessing during your research. Maybe you could bring us back and tell us just a little bit about the context of the cinema industry, both in the colonial period, the pre-independence period, but also then what that shift looked like in the 90s. What kind of access did people have to cinema before that? Mm-hmm. What kinds of visual media were being created for them?
Well, even before the British colonial administration started to adopt cinema as a kind of propaganda mode, it was very much at the time of the Second World War, right, to communicate also knowledge about these global events. So before that time, there were already quite a number of films in circulation and in cinemas run often by Indians, but also by some Ghanaians, and these were movies featuring Chaplin, for example. So those movies were very, very popular, and also early silent films. Even after it was possible to make sound films, often the equipment was not there. So there was already from this early moment a tradition of not having sound, but having to make the sound, as it were, by way of commenting on the movies. There were commentators on the movies, and the audiences also engaged with what they saw on screen in a very active and exuberant and loud manner. With independence in 1957, so the first president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, was very fond of film and saw it as a potential medium to bring about the integration of the nation and national unity. So he, in a way, transformed the colonial film unit in the Ghana Films and Industry Corporation, which was very, very important to him, and in which he invested much until the rise of television in the mid-1960s, just shortly before he was destituted. He had to leave presidency via a coup. And for Nkrumah, film was a very important medium, indeed, not only for the integration of the nation, but also for invoking a vision of an African personality. And since these days, in fact, cinema was one of the ways of citizenship education, right? So education being a very, very important notion here. What I noted is, well, the state film industry went on, but they always had quite little funds to do feature films. There were quite a number of documentary films made, but it was not a really thriving film industry, which eventually, in the mid-1990s, was even privatized and sold to a Malaysian television company. So at that time, since the mid to late 1980s, local filmmakers already were standing in the void. People wanted to watch films, but there was nothing around. And so they developed a substitute for cinema with the medium of video. And what was interesting, that in many ways, they used this new medium of video in we could say, old ways that were grafted upon the use of a cinema, and many understandings and expectations with regard to the medium of film were also retained, especially the educative and also moralizing undertones. This was also something audiences very much expected. But where and how these locally produced video films differed from the format of film as education maintained by the state was with regard to the depiction of the occult and so on. And there was a real digression between indeed the idea of Nkrumah those days to present very positive images of African personality and indigenous culture, and the way in which the video film movies mobilized the local gods and spirits also in terms of dangerous forces that were diabolized very much in line with a Christian take on local religion and culture.
In that initial moment that you described, seeing that poster for Diabolo, we both get this notion of the diabolization, the occult that you've been talking about, but also the fact that you were seeing this poster when you come into Accra, when you come into the urban space. And one of my very favorite chapters in the book, maybe because I didn't know it would be there, was the chapter where you talked about this issue of urban space, how Accra is presented in these video films, and indeed how Africa is therefore represented in these films too. Could you tell us a bit more about that entanglement of the urban landscape, the neoliberal capitalism, and the kind of fantasy that's depicted in these films?
Well, what struck me immediately was a very selective and partial representation of Accra. So there was a very strong preference to show the latest hotel, the nicest restaurant, to show high buildings, to also very much depict in a way what in local understandings was seen as development. This was also one of the attraction points to these movies for people in the diaspora who said, Ghana is also developing. You see, we have this and this and this in Accra. I often asked filmmakers why they would not perhaps go more for the picturesque or the messy, the markets and so on. And they said, no, why is it that you as a European always want to look at a messy and Africa, which you may find colorful? We want to show the extent to which Africa resembles the modern world. We also have development and so on. What I found interesting is that in a great deal of the movies, there is a depiction of the city that is partial, that really focuses on these modern aspects. And I saw it as laying bare, in fact, an urban imaginary of a city yet to come that resonated very much with people and their expectations. And that also tied into images of earlier nationhood, where we could also find similar emblems of, in a way, the city as a site of development and modernity that was also taken up in these movies. So I would say that film, in many ways also expressed and helped realize an urban imaginary of a kind of modern city that was not quite there on the level of everyday life, and that was at the same time very much aspired to.
There's something really interesting about temporality in this book because, as you said, there is both the depiction of the city yet to come and yet the past, in the context of these movies, the past as in these questions about the occult and how the occult still functions. I mean, this is very much front and center. And all of this in sensational movies, all of this is also filtered through, of course, Pentecostal Christianity, which is one of the frameworks for which these movies are being developed. So for those listeners who don't know that much about Pentecostal Christianity, or in particular, perhaps in Ghana, it might also be helpful to clarify some of the background about its role and its spread, especially in the South, where you conduct your field work. What does Pentecostalism look like in southern Ghana? Are we talking about a large number of people who are Pentecostal? Pentecostal light is how you've been discussing this. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, well, what struck me in a way from the outside in my work, even in a village setting in southern Ghana, was a kind of struggle going on even within a Presbyterian church about the importance attributed to the Holy Spirit and the capacity of the Holy Spirit indeed to get into people and to make a radical change in their lives. And during my research in that village in Peking, the church even broke into two parts. So the group emphasizing the importance of the Holy Spirit, of speaking in tongues and all that, and of deliverance of demons became very, very popular. And once I shifted my research to Accra, I also realized that in the city even more, that this was a very, very prominent movement. On the one hand, there were lots of newly founded charismatic churches founded by Ghanaian leaders like Christian Action Faith ministries and others. But at the same time, the strong emphasis on the power of the Holy Spirit to make a change in one's personal life also caught on very much within the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, and in the Presbyterian churches. So in many ways, I found that grassroots understandings of Christianity and expectations of what Christianity would have to offer were moving into the direction of Pentecostalism, which is, I think, a very interesting religiosity in that it is a religiosity that makes people very mobile, as it were, the emphasis being very much of the Holy Spirit that people feel touched by and by which they feel to be filled. So that is a very, very important aspect. It's a religiosity through which people also feel mobilized and able to be on the move, to be out from the village to the big city and from the big city to Europe and other parts of the world. It is also a religiosity that is very much tied to modernity. It may also be seen by people as indeed a harbinger of finally becoming modern and doing well in life. There's a strong emphasis on healing and also on wealth, the achievement of wealth. It's partly also as formulated in the prosperity gospel, but not necessarily. And at the flip side of this, there is a very strong emphasis on diabolization. One often hears the cry, make a complete break with the past, and by this it is meant that, in fact, indigenous religious tradition, though of course being very present and still alive in the present, is temporalized as something backward, as something belonging to the past from which people in a way seek to distance themselves. So it is a very, I would say, it's interesting to look at Pentecostalism from a perspective of time and temporalization. It is a religiosity that very much invests into a particular a future of progress, indeed, that were also a fulfillment. We think of Ferguson's book, of expectations of modernity. So the fulfillment of hitherto frustrated expectations is in a way promised to come with Pentecostalism. And at the dark side of it, there is this very strong concern with the forces that hamper these developments. So the forces, powers of darkness, the occult, and so on. And in my own research, I have always tried to look at these two dimensions together, and it is a dualistic take, which one also finds very much in the video movies.
It really comes out in the book that there is this kind of synoptic dualism, we could say, in the video films, where both the urban landscape as well as Pentecostalism are part of creating, as you say, a city yet to come, but we could also talk about an Africa yet to come, and both aspects are functioning within these video films
that you describe.
And I should say that we've been using the terms like religion and religiosity, mm-hmm. and this is all very good because, of course, we are talking about new books in religion. Mm-hmm. So we're using the category, but it is certainly in your work in general and in this book too, in Sensational Movies, religion is a very expansive kind of term. I mean, it's a very expansive sort of category. It happens everywhere, as you point out in this book. So listeners should also be aware of the fact that as we're talking here, we're also talking about something rather expansive, the ways that these video movies express these phenomena that you're talking about, but also travel in other kinds of ways into the public sphere. Yeah.
You know, in my previous research, of course, I have spent time to look at processes of conversion and all that. But what attracted me to study the film industry was that it allowed me to understand the implications of the spread of the evangelizing gospel throughout a public sphere that was no longer contained, as it were, by the state in ways in which it had been contained and controlled before. And what I found interesting was indeed the spread of Pentecostal imagery, Pentecostal modes of sensing the world, Pentecostal narratives and moralities, also via this video film industry, which of course was never run by Pentecostal churches, but in a way enhanced also the popularity of this, in a way, mode of being in the world via the movies. In so doing, of course, something paradoxical also happened. For if indeed religion becomes unbounded as a category, if it is everywhere and nowhere, if it is so easily reproduced and copied and brought into the sphere of entertainment, it indeed may become very much of a surface phenomenon that may run counter to aspirations of piety and sincerity. And that is also something that has very much interested me. So when I talk about Pentecostalite culture or the spread of Pentecostalism, I don't talk about the spread of a deeply sincere, pious attitude, but I talk about the spread, the encroachment, one could also perhaps say, on the public sphere of a particular mood and attitude. Mm. And the films, I think, very much tie into this.
And it's a mood and an attitude that's informed by, as you note in the book, Christian modes of viewing. Mm-hmm. So we can maybe get into, in some ways, the heart of your research, which is the ways that issues related to vision, as well as the visible and the invisible, mm-hmm. How those kinds of things inform the video films that you've studied.
Mm. Well, what is important to realize that of course, the Southern Ghana is multi-ethnic, right? But in the various local languages, there is a difference made between what is called the physical world and the spiritual world. And there is a very strong awareness on the part of people that next to the physical world, which is accessible to the eye and to the other senses, there is another sphere that impinges on that world, but that is not easily graspable. So what people often say is that we are in demand of some extra vision being very much emphasized. And a lot of preaching, for example, as well as, in fact, also the services offered by traditional priests goes into making visible what is around, but what cannot easily be seen. So pastors, but also local indigenous priests talking about things they can see thanks to their link with spiritual powers, and that they can make visible, often then via words, of course. And the interesting thing is that the video movies, a very great strand in these movies tied into this modus of making visible the unseen, as it were, and then set out to indeed picture especially the occult, but also the operation of God and all the effects in these movies. And this is, I found, one of the major attraction points of these movies, that they tie into Christian modes of looking and in a way claim to make visible something that is unseen. What struck me very much when talking to audiences about these movies is that they would say, okay, these films are made, of course, by producers, but they are not just fictions. They teach us something about the unseen, which are not, which is not so easy to see, and which resonates with what we hear in Pentecostal sermons, which resonates also with dreams and so on. And it is in this sense that the movies indeed audiovisualize a particular imaginary that is often evoked in words. But they, of course, films have at their disposal the moving image. And so this, this is something what happens, which is also why I talk about film as revelation. It is also striking that a great deal of movies, either in the beginning or the end, has a quote from the Bible or says, thank you, Jesus, thank you, God, and so on. So also tying, in a way, the movie into a kind of the genre of a testimony, we could say.
It's so important for a reworking of notions of fetish, which is something that you've been working on for many, many years, but to think about the ways that in practice humans, and anyway Ghanaians, can both recognize something as produced by human beings and yet also be revelation and also be something that is directed by, in some sense, the actions of the spirit in the world.
Exactly. And this need not at all be a contradiction, right? So I think it may well be, it may be a kind of legacy of a Protestant take on God as so completely other that he or she resists any representation. But I think that in what I encountered in the Ghanaian context was indeed also some trust in the capacity of the human hands and media to indeed develop the possibility to mediate and render present that what is unseen. And so this is always made and made up, and yet it can be vested with some truth. And I found this a very, very important realization, which, of course, I think may be of larger importance also in our approach of religion as a practice of mediation that necessarily requires tangible forms in order to, in a way, produce transcendence. So my research in this field also alerted me to the limitations of a dualistic distance between the divine or transcendence and then the immanent. And I also, thanks to these experiences in this Ghanaian world, I got very much alerted to the ways in which religion may be seen as a system that mediates something that is not there in a direct manner, as it were.
Could you give us an example from one of the films that you studied that would give our listeners more of a sense of precisely what happens on the screen when something invisible gets tangibilized or gets filtered through this media?
Yeah, well, of course, what was very important from the outset were what one could call special effects. And of course, where people very much specialize in developing special effects with the rise of Adobe Premiere. So digital technologies, it was also more easy to produce special effects. Mm-hmm. Now there were, of course, lots of anxieties and talks about witchcraft, and there are lots of narratives about, in a way, the shapes which witches may take, the owl or vulture, and so on. So in the early movies already, there were attempts to show how people would transform themselves from being a person lying down and then becoming, in a way, a witch by showing a particular animal shape coming out of the person. And such kind of scenes are very spectacular. And again, people know this is made for the film, but it resonates very much with local ideas about witchcraft, for example. There are also plenty of depictions about the devil, which often strikes me as quite medieval devil. I was very interested on the whole in the representation of demons and noted that filmmakers might take as an example, of course, European horror movies, or even look at encyclopedias of witchcraft and so on in order to get the iconographies right. But so there was a lot of investment in special effects through which indeed these unseen demons about which people talked a lot were being depicted. And one used materials from horror films, films about ghosts and so on, and similar techniques very much.
I was thinking specifically about your discussion about what you call the techno-religious, which I think is a helpful one, especially for those of our listeners who are at the intersection of media studies and religious studies, perhaps. Could you talk a little bit more about that intersection and this notion of the techno-religious?
That ties, of course, into what we just said about mediation, so the importance of media to produce a sense of something that is not present as such, we could say. And the video movies very much alerted me to the importance of particular technologies, so the special effect technologies, as it were, to produce particular visions into this realm of the unseen. So when I talk about the techno-religious, I talk about, indeed, the use of particular technologies of depiction, of making visible for religious purposes. It is impossible to completely disentangle these domains, as it were. I very much agree with the work of Hente Vries, for example, whose work I'm also quoting, or the work of Jeremy Stoloff, too, who has been pointing to the importance of the use of technologies, in a way, in the depiction of the spiritual. It would make little sense to claim that technologies and the realm of spirits or the divine are independent domains. We see, in fact, so many examples in which these two are brought together, and I try to circumscribe this with this notion of a techno-religious realism that creates certain images of an unseen that are vested with truth, as it were.
And one of the really important points here is that Sensational Movies does such a great job at really getting us beyond an earlier discussion that was all about how religion is depicted in media, we could say, and rather views religion as media. Exactly. And as you've been talking about, this very dense interweaving of the actual technological practices at play, the affordances that they have, and also the spiritual realm in which people live.
Exactly. I think you say that. Yes, exactly. That's what I tried to convey.
How do filmmakers engage their audiences? You were talking before about those early silent films, and people were talking back to the film and engaging them. And you do such a nice job in this book also of giving us a sense of what watching practices, especially in the home, once people are able to get these videos for themselves, what that looks like. How does a Ghanaian audience watch these movies? What was it like for you as you were conducting fieldwork with audience members?
Well, I was very much alerted to the fact that viewing is a social affair. Of course, with video technology becoming, with people having video players at home, they could also watch alone. But the big fun during the period of my research, at least, was in watching films together. So what I noted, I said with audiences so much, in my own home, visiting people, and then in the small video parlors, and as long as it lasted, also in the bigger cinemas. Most of the cinemas have now become shopping malls or churches, right? But there are still public viewing sessions. And what always intrigued me was the strong audience engagement, and they talk very much about what they would see on screen, raising certain, cracking jokes, of course, but
during talking, the movie.
Yes, during the movie. So it was always somewhat loud, as it were. And I realized also the sound quality is not perfect. Now it's much better than in the beginning. But I realized that exactly the imperfection of sound also invited a stronger audience engagement with the images on screen. So I realized that the, let's say, real performance, the real film always demanded the oral engagement of the audiences to make it into a kind of full and rewarding experience. So it was very performative, I would say, and sensational indeed, in many, many ways, which is a different way of viewing than I had been used to so far. In the beginning of my research, I also expected that one would perhaps watch a movie and then discuss it a bit, but I quickly realized that in a way, the movie is discussed in response to what people see on the screen. So I took lots of notes, also recorded screenings, and became much more alert then later to the ways in which films would be referred to more casually in people's lives. I realized that people were looking to get something out of movies. So what they were critical about movies. Mm. If a movie would not help them to get something out of it, if it would not show something important, something invisible that they were interested in, or if a movie would not be able to give some moral guidelines, they would not like it. So there was a certain preference. And video filmmakers, since you asked about this, were very much aware that they made movies that were not so much appreciated by the people who were still standing in a way for the former state film establishment. So the industry depended very much on the appraisal of the audiences. So they very much sat with the audience, studied what they were, how they were responding, and so on. And also, in a way, made the films in such a way that they would be successful, interactive pieces that would trigger responses. So that makes it this phenomenon very, very interesting for me as an anthropologist, of course. We use this, the study of this medium also as a way to learn about a world of lived experience, to learn about a popular imagination. So filmmakers themselves did their best to stay quite close to what was en vogue, what was popular.
Thinking about these things as a co-creative process, even in the act of watching, certainly reminds us that people don't watch films in quite the same way in all places in the world.
Exactly.
Something that you mentioned earlier that I think is probably important in this context is also the potentially dangerous quality of a film that is recreating the occult, even if it's recreating it in order to ultimately send a certain kind of moral message. In what ways was that kind of danger dealt with, both by audiences and also because you went behind the scenes in the production of these films, by the actors and filmmakers themselves?
Yeah, well, that is a very important question. And I also identified a kind of paradox, one could say, in this type of movies. That's, of course, in this claim to show what happens in the unseen, to in a way depict, to audiovisualize the powers of darkness, they invested a lot in showing how these powers operate, and this was one of the big attraction points. So one finds a very, very strong investment, as it were, in the whole domain of the occult that could only be contained by indeed presenting some kind of framework. So yes, we show you all these occult forces, but the film still had on a meta level have as a message that this was a bad thing to go into. But of course, audiences were very much fascinated by this. And I talked to quite a number of pastors too, and serious, staunch Christians, and some of them also voiced their concerns by saying, okay, yeah, the films, they have, indeed, they follow a Christian take on the world, but they very much emphasize the occult, without necessarily always creating the closure that would be needed. So people who watch these movies, or they don't watch them from beginning to end, they may end up having all kinds of images of the occult enter their imagination, and these images may run wild without indeed some closure being achieved. I also noted that certainly younger people. I followed a group of young teenagers, and we went to the cinema in the early phase of my research. And I noted that they very actively embraced prayer in order to, protect themselves against potential evil that would come by watching particular images. So there was definitely an idea that the imaginaries depicted on screen might easily flip and enter people's mind and perhaps pollute or spoil them. And likewise, since you asked about the set, I also noted that, well, on set, every shooting started and ended with prayer. But there were also, of course, scenes to be shot that would involve the depiction of witches or the occult, and so on. I interviewed quite a number of actors about how they felt about this, and I heard from many that they went to their pastor to do some prayers as to protect themselves against the danger of mimesis. Of course, they said, well, we make a film about the occult, so someone has to play the devil or a demon or a priest, but there was still the sense that it might be tricky to, in fact, mimetically take up this role. It might be more than a role. It might somehow, by becoming the image, of course, on screen, somehow that what is depicted might enter into oneself. So there was quite some concern about that. I have one chapter, I think chapter 6, in which I write about the danger of animation, which comes with indeed the bringing to life of the occult, and also of traditional rituals and all that.
It's a wonderful parallel with how we were talking earlier about both Pentecostalism, but also these movies spilling out into a public sphere, and in this sense of being unable to contain potentially the occult once you put out into circulation these videos is a fascinating parallel with the larger one in terms of the public discourse, the public sphere, and the way that these Christian modes of viewing and thinking also are uncontained, spill out into it.
If the spirits once called upon, as if we think even of Goethe also, it's very difficult to get rid of them.
That's right. How do you put the genie back in the bottle?
Exactly. Once certain figments are produced, they are very difficult to be contained. They originate from the human imagination, but they are vested with a life of their own, and even if people are very much aware that it is humans who created them, still the images are there and have a particular force, which also makes that they have to be handled in particular ways. So in this sense, I could say that doing this research on these movies also alerted me to the complexities of human object entanglements, which of course are by no way limited to this field. So what I definitely do not want to do is in a way to offer an image of an exoticized Africa. I think that many of the mechanisms I found in this functioning of the video film industry with regard to the representation of the unseen also would apply to, in a way, the world at large.
Right? And I think another theme that runs mainly in one of your chapters, actually, but runs to some degree throughout the book, that resonates much more broadly than Ghana or Africa, is this question about heritage making in the context of the state apparatus. And this is something that's of particular interest to me because it dovetails with some of the things I've been thinking about in terms of the Canadian, the Quebec context. Mm-hmm. As you point out in the book, the view of Indigenous religions and the way that they're depicted in other kinds of films or art that are related to heritage making is very different than how these Pentecostal or Christian modes of viewing understand the occult and Indigenous religions. religions. Yeah. Could you speak to that briefly?
Yeah, I would say in the beginning of the film industry, there was a very strong cleavage in a way. So there was on the part of the state also an idea of cherishing heritage on the this idea of African personality, Sankofaism, as it is also called, Sankofa being a symbol of the bird looking back, meaning go back and take it. So a positive stance to tradition that needs to be picked up and carried to the future, opposed to a Pentecostal inclination to very much see that heritage as the demonic, something to make a complete break from, right? And for a great deal, certainly of the early films, they all went into this very much, so diabolizing, in fact, what was cherished as heritage in other registers. But I also noted during my research that at some point an interest emerged in a new genre of movies, the epic films, which also found, in a way, the village to be an interesting scene, the village having been very much diabolized as an abode of the occult in earlier films. And in the epic, what was interesting is that the epic was usually located in pre-colonial, pre-Christian times, so in an ancient past, when also the people depicted there did not yet have to make a choice between being Christian or not. And I noted that, this was an emergent genre that would, in a way, situate itself in a more positive relation to Africa and Africanness, and in certain ways to heritage. But what was interesting is that the imagination of tradition was extremely fictitious. So I talked to some set designers who said, "Yeah, we are inventing unexisting traditions, ever more, ever new," and it was a very aestheticized depiction of tradition. This genre never became very, very smashing and extremely popular, but I saw it as an interesting opening that also resonated with a kind of shift. I also would like to pursue that in future research, a shift in stance towards heritage, towards Africanness, that tries to embrace certain elements in a way via the registers of the symbolic or the aesthetic, not as in terms of a real with certain spirits behind that have a real presence, but rather as a mode of or a style perhaps of something that signifies Africanness. And so these openings I also found, but one would have to see how this would develop further.
You have this great section of pages in the book where you talk about speaking with a Nigerian. I believe he's Nigerian-born, but in Ghana now.
Yeah, exactly.
But set
I think
designer,
he's now back in Nigeria.
Okay. A set designer who's saying, look, you know, the altars weren't all that interesting looking. Mm. So when I produce heritage, then I'm creating something even more spectacular. Which I just thought was such a wonderful conversation that you were having with him.
That was also a Ghanaian filmmaker who I talked about this a lot, Michael Akwati Kani, one of the filmmakers to whom I dedicated the book. There was a big debate how to represent African tradition, and on one level, there were people who said, "Oh, these movies, they always represent African tradition in a bad way." But there were also people who were so much into, in a way, indigenous religion or in a way the context with the spirit, that they said these films don't represent anything because what we are dealing with is not representable on film. Anyhow, filmmakers, when I interviewed them, asked them, how much do you know about African indigenous traditions and so on? They said, we get a lot out of coffee table books and so on. For in a real shrine, there is just a pot, there is so little there. You need something slightly more spectacular. So what happened, of course, was that the representation of indigenous tradition was in a way also very much framed by Hollywood images of a kind of an African occult. And that matched, in a way, very much the position of priests and chiefs, who also said, the films misrepresent us, but also we are not we are not representable. And what filmmakers, and we're acknowledging that and saying, yeah, we also need to go for an appealing picture.
So this is sort of aesthetics of
exactly.
colorful
so the, yeah, exactly. And they very much created substitutes that were much closer in a way to kind of outside imagination of African religion and tradition than what one might find within the context of priesthood chieftains.
So it sounds like heritage is one avenue maybe for further research in your own work. Mm-hmm. What are some other things that you're working on now?
There are, in a way, quite a number of projects, but I certainly will continue doing research also on religion and society in Ghana for the future. I intend to engage in a collaborative project with a number of my Ghanaian colleagues as well, and that will focus on a multi-ethnic, multi-religious neighborhood. Of course, I noted that's also what this book is about, that people are very serious about religion. So you hear and see signs of the Pentecostals everywhere. You also see lots of signs that indicate the presence of Islam. And I'm very much interested to do some research about Muslim-Christian relations within on the level of neighborhoods. And on another level, I'm also very much interested to pursue, in a way, an understanding of religion in terms of mediation, to which media are intrinsic, so certain authorized material forms. And I will also engage in more comparative research that would look at buildings, objects, images, but also food and the body, text as multiple media of religion, both in Africa but also in the West. Whilst working on the book, I also shifted from a position in anthropology to religious studies. This also broadened my horizon a bit, and I'm also very eager to do more work on global entanglements and also help develop possibilities for comparison.
And this connects to some of the work that you've been coming out with more recently. Well, this is rather recent too, but yeah. But of course you publish so much that there's other recent work as well on icons and iconicity, and so it sounds mm-hmm. like some of those things you were talking about in the last part of your answer is also connecting to that work.
I think I see this book very much as an ethnography of the religious imagination that is in a way unlocked via a focus on the image, and also the image indeed as a material form in the interface of religion and film or video technology. But this whole question of the religious imagination, the image, the idol, the icon, has occupied me very much. I have, of course, also explored the genealogy of these notions, and I'm very much interested in indeed the phenomenon of iconicity, issues of idolatry, larger themes in the interface of visual culture. So I think of Latour and W.T. Mitchell, but also some German scholars like Belting and Böhm and so on. And that is definitely a field in which I will also invest further. Yeah.
Thank you so much for spending the time to talk to us today and to be in Montreal.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.